since 1971.
This is ridiculous. You know, a tag is where you read something after a commercial is over. It doesn't say the name of the place or anything. Could be a butcher shop. Must be a record store around there somewhere.
The home of rock and roll throughout the 70s and into the 80s.
Hi, everybody. I'm Ken Kelly.
And I'm Lynn Woodison.
Join us tomorrow as we rock the Motor City bigger than all Texas, the Thursday edition of the Riff Rock and Roll Morning Show.
Detroit's only real rock and roll radio station in the decade of the 90s.
A beautiful 74 rock and roll over degrees in Detroit City. Well, finishing off the last half hour of a 60-minute nonstop rock and roll jam for you, commercial-free on the Riff.
If it rocks, it's on the Riff in the early part of the 21st century.
You're like, yeah, just call us at 248-54-RIFF. Or you could call us at 1-855.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF. Here is Mike Staff with our special guest, Mike Staff.
Hey guys, welcome to the history of WRIF. I'm Meltdown. I've been on Riff for almost 25 years now. In about 3 weeks, it'll be 25 years. But normally Mike Staff is doing the intro, but since I'm interviewing Mike Staff, I thought, well, heck, I have to do the intro now. So how you doing, Mike?
Great to see you, Meltdown, once again. We did this a couple of weeks ago, and here we are again in northern Michigan.
That's right. We're up here in Traverse City, and this time around, we were by the lake last time. And but this time we're in your backyard. We got a fire cranked up, and we got the microphones attached to our shirts, and we're just going to talk about your time at WRIF over your 14-year period. So what were the years you were there?
So I got there in 1992, and I left and moved up here to Traverse City in 2006. So
okay.
14 years,
yeah. So let's start at the beginning. So when did you get the radio bug? And I know that we've talked about this before, I don't think on the air or anything, but you always wanted to be on Riff. So when did you decide or get the, you know, the gumption that you wanted to be on the radio?
Yeah, for me, as long as I can remember, I wanted to be a DJ on the Riff. I remember when I was 4 years old, my older brother brought home a 45 of Led Zeppelin's Black Dog.
Really?
And I put it on, and I had my dad's big, super clunky headphones, and I'd crank it over and over, and I'm not even sure I knew why I loved it so much, but I did.
Yeah.
And my brother told me that, yeah, you can hear this stuff on this radio station, WRIF. And I started listening to the Riff in 1974. And
so is that your earliest memory of hearing a rock song?
Yeah, oh, definitely.
Yeah.
It was, yep, Led Zeppelin, Black Dog. But at the time, you know, Riff was playing Sabbath and Deep Purple in it. It was the heavy, heavy guitars that really got me. And then, so I was hooked, and I would be listening to the radio all the time. And I would go to bed at night at 10 years old, and I'd, you know, put my headphones on and go under the covers and listen to Riff. And I'd listen to DJs talk about this great music.
So who are the DJs that you're listening to? Do you remember?
Peter Werby was definitely one of them. There's a guy, Mark Daddy Addy.
Yeah, yeah.
Mark was there. Steve Costan came a little bit later. I'm trying to think those late night guys that I love. I think it was Mark Addy and Peter Werby were the ones that I listened to the most back. I mean, I'm talking early 1970s.
Right. And it's like back then, that was like the time of WKRP in Cincinnati. And you had this
right.
whole preconceived image in your head of what was going on. And a lot of that was probably true back then.
Right. Exactly. Yeah. That probably came out in 1980 or so.
Yeah.
It's really funny though. Like if you talk to my friends from elementary school, junior high school, they will all tell you that I was the guy that always said, I'm going to be on the Riff. And it wasn't like I just wanted to be in radio. I wanted to be a DJ on the Riff.
Right.
To me, Riff was the pinnacle.
Well,
you know?
I think that we talked about this last time, that when I came to Detroit to interview, when I pulled in the parking lot and saw those Riff fans with the iconic symbol and stuff, I'm
the logo.
It kind of gave me like goosebumps right away. So, so how does your radio career start?
So I graduated from high school, and I went to Central Michigan University for about half a semester, partied myself out of it. But the one thing that I did do was I was on the radio. I had a newscast at noon, and then I'd always be hanging around the radio station. So if a DJ couldn't make it, I could go on the air and be on the air. So that's the one good thing that came out of Central, but it just wasn't working for me. I was partying a little bit too hard.
Yeah.
And I ended up coming home and going to Spex Howard, which is a broadcast school in Detroit, which was the best thing that could have happened to me. So when I was going to Spex.
And what year is this?
It was 1987.
Okay, so you're going to specs.
Going to specs. And after about maybe 4 months or so, they say, hey, you can get an internship now. So I got two internships. One was at WJR AM because it was the only thing that was available at the time.
And who were you working with at that station?
Well, the guy's name is Bill Plagg, and he was a producer for J.P. McCarthy. Now, J.P. McCarthy was like the king of Detroit radio at that time. So it was a really cool internship.
So you got to meet J.P. and all that?
Got to meet J.P. and kind of see how this whole big-time radio show comes together. You know, in fact, when I was an intern at WJR, I got to talk to George H.W. Bush on the phone just for half a second.
That's so cool.
But back then, there wasn't like satellite radio, and WJR was a clear signal radio station, which means that it's the only AM 760 frequency on the dial. So this radio station would boom into Florida at night.
Right.
And so it had a ton of clout. So back then, a guy like JP, who was number one across the board, could get interviews with the sitting president.
Yeah.
So the president called, and the producer was really cool. He was my buddy, and he's like, hey, you want to talk to the president? Just pick up the phone and tell him that Mr. McCarthy will be with him in a minute. So I got to talk to him for a second. That was really cool.
That's funny. I had experience like that with George Thorogood. I think that the DJ left the studio for a second to go get whatever it again. And so I talked to George Thorogood on the, you know, on the phone for just a second. I remember him not being very nice, but he was probably pressed for time. He didn't want to talk to some punk
intern. But about 2 months after I got the internship at WJR, an internship at Wheels opened up. That was 98.7 WLLZ. And so I got that internship, and that is the one that kind of changed my career trajectory, because that's where I met Doug Podell, who was a program director and did nights at Wheels. I met Bob Bauer and some other people that really became mentors to
me. And this is around 1988?
That was 1987.
Okay, same year, okay.
Yep. So then I graduated from Specs, and I got a job at this little AM radio station out in Mount Clemens. It's not there anymore. It's a 500-watt AM radio station. So to give you an idea of how much power a 500-watt station has, go home and look at your hair dryer. It's got 1,200 watts, you know. I swear nobody listened to this station but my mom and my grandmother. But
yeah, your hair dryer had better ratings, but go ahead.
Yeah, probably did. But it gave me an opportunity to be on the air. And I was making $3.35 an hour, working minimum wage, and nobody was listening.
And what were you doing at the station?
I was a DJ on the weekends.
Okay, so what kind of music were they playing?
Oh, God, they were playing like Neil Diamond and Barbra Streisand and America and stuff like that. You know, I hated the music, but it gave me a chance to be on the air.
For sure. And like, when you're starting out in radio, that's all you want. I was just talking with somebody the other day, and it's like, I don't know if we discussed this last time, but I worked for 8 months without a day off.
Right.
It was an oversight.
Sure.
But I didn't complain.
Because you're doing what you love.
I know it. I wanted to be on the radio. I wanted to do it. I wanted the experience. I wanted to work hard, you know?
Yeah.
And so for you, you were doing this, and it's like, yeah, you're playing, you know, ABBA or whatever you're playing, but you're on the air and you get a chance to, like, you know, maybe set yourself up for something down the road. So you're interning at LLZ, and what happens?
Well, so I'm interning so I'm at this little AM station for about a year. I'm interning at Wheels and I'm interning at WJR all over the course of about a year. And Doug Podell and I became pretty good friends. And he really kind of took me under his wing, and he was mentoring me. And he said, hey, there's a radio station in Traverse City called WKLT. It's a great rock station.
Which is still on the air to this
day. Still on the air here in Traverse City. And he said, I really think it would be a great opportunity for you. So if you want the job, I can call the program director and see if, you know, maybe I can pull a few strings. And it worked. So I moved to Traverse City, dude, and it was a job for 8 hours a week at $4 an hour. And
so what else were you doing up here?
Well, I did anything I had to make a buck. I mean, I waited tables. I delivered pizzas. I was a maid in a hotel for about 3.5 hours, and I just hated that job, and I couldn't do it. But I did whatever I had to, you know, to make a buck. In fact, I lived in this apartment building, had 8 units in, and I moved here in December, and it snows every single day.
Right.
And so I knocked on all my neighbor's door, and I said, hey, if you give me $5 a week, I will start your car every single morning and wipe all the snow off it.
Wow.
So they all took me up on it, and that paid my rent.
Really?
So I was just trying to do anything I could to make a buck to try to support my habit of being in radio, because I just wanted it so bad. And then after about a year, I ended up getting a full-time job at Riff, and I was promotions director, and then I did 10 at night till 3 in the morning. And it was great. Just awesome.
10 at night to 3 in the morning. What year was that?
I must have been 1989.
Okay, so 1989 you started Riff.
1989 started KLT.
Oh, okay, I got you. Okay, yep, I just said Riff.
Yep,
okay.
Traverse City. And then, so I'm here for at Traverse City for a couple of years. And then I got fired for something stupid. And it's interesting because when I was going to radio school, Dick Kernan, who was like the VP of Specs Howard, he's actually the first program director of Riff. But he was a teacher, and he said, listen, here's the deal. If you're going to get into radio, you're going to work formats that you can't stand. You're going to work overnights and holidays. You're going to get fired for no reason. People are going to get promoted over you, and they shouldn't. This is radio, so just get used to it. So when all those things happen to me in radio, I'm like, sweet, man, par for the course. I'm right where I'm supposed to be.
Yeah, you're here.
Yep.
Well, they say, you know, there's an old saying in radio for those that aren't in radio. It's like, you really haven't worked in radio until you've been fired.
Right, so, yeah, exactly.
You know. And, you know, we've all been there. So you're working here in Traverse City, what years, 89 to?
89, 90. And 1990, I got fired, and I was kind of on the beach for 6 months. I couldn't find a job my life depended on. I sent out so many tapes and resumes. And then I finally called Doug Podell again. And at the time, Doug was in Cleveland at WNCX. And he got me the job at Riff, so I was a little, or at KLT, so I was kind of like, I don't want to call this guy and tell him I got fired.
Right.
But I did, and instantly he's like, hey, I got a buddy in Youngstown, Ohio. Let me give him a call. And 2 hours later, I was on my way to Youngstown at WNCD, the Wolf, CD 106, the Wolf in Youngstown.
And that was a rock station, too?
It was a rock station, yeah. Big-time rock station. And blue-collar Youngstown, it was so much like Detroit, like yeah. A mini version of Detroit. And so I did mornings in Youngstown and for 6 months to the day. And I was talking to Doug the whole time. And Doug was trying to get me to do some weekend work in Cleveland. And I'm like, wow, this is cool. A much bigger market than Youngstown. So I thought I'd do both for a while. And then Riff called. And I called Doug and I said, man, I got this opportunity at Riff.
Wait a second. Hold on. Back up for 1 second. So how does Riff call you?
Well, that's a interesting thing because Jim Pemberton was the name of the program director. Jim Kelly was his radio name. And Jim and Doug were best friends. In fact, Doug was the best man in Jim's wedding.
Okay.
And they were both at Wheels when I was at Wheels, so I knew them both.
Okay, I got you.
And so I kind of kept in touch with Jim a little bit. I kept in touch with Doug, too. So when Jim called me and I said, hey, I was actually talking to Podell about doing some stuff in Cleveland. So I called Doug and told him that, and he called Jim and said, yeah, go ahead and take Mike. So I moved back to Detroit 6 months to the day after moving to Youngstown, and I was like,
so you're
yeah,
only in Youngstown
baby.
For 6 months. That's yep. A short stint.
Yeah.
So then what year is this now?
So 92, okay. I got to Riff. February of 92, I was 23.
And what were you doing at Riff?
I got hired in to do two overnight weekend shifts.
Uh-huh.
Yep, so I did Friday night, Saturday morning, 2 a.m. to 6 a.m., Friday and Saturday
night. That's a tough slog. So what did you do the rest of the week?
Again, I like it's so funny, you know, because my lifelong dream is to be at Riff, and I'm thinking, yeah, when I get to Riff, you know, I'm going to be cruising around in limos, and I'm going to be hanging out with, you know, strippers and rock stars all the time, and I move into my mom's house, you know, and I'm waiting tables again, just kind of waiting for it to happen. But it happened pretty fast for me at Riff, so it didn't take about 6 months before I was making enough money to be able to support myself.
Coming up.
And Costan was there, and Arthur P. was there, and those guys were all kind of broadcasting live, and at the end of the shift, they said, hey, our newest DJ, Mike Staff, is back in the station. Arthur says, hey, go on the air, let's see what you sound like. So I open up the mic, and
that's
I said,
the first time you're on Riff.
First time ever. And right. I said, hey, guys, how's it going? And the first thing ever, Arthur says, oh, my God, he sounds like Costan. and it didn't take me long to figure out that there was only one Steve Costan, and there wasn't room for two of us. So I kind of had to figure out my own style at that point, you know.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
From Pontiac to Plymouth, you 101 WRIF, Detroit.
This is rock and roll.
Go ahead, tell me more.
Legendary personalities from Detroit's iconic WRIF.
Do you remember the first time you met Arthur?
I do, yeah. And I remember the first time I talked to him on the air. So when you're young in radio and you're raised in a city like Detroit, you have DJs that you gravitate towards, that you really want to emulate, that you think sound really cool, you know? And for me, it was Steve Costan. I just thought Steve Costan was the coolest sounding rock jock ever.
I can kind of see that, you know, from your style and talking you and knowing you. Yeah, okay.
Yeah, so when I was, like, bouncing around Traverse City, Youngstown, I was really kind of trying to emulate Steve Costan. So my very first shift I ever worked at Riff, I was running the board, which means I'm back in the studio, and Ann Carlini was at Kobo for the auto show, and Costan was there, and Arthur P was there, and those guys were all kind of broadcasting live. And at the end of the shift, they said, "Hey, our newest DJ, Mike Staff, is back in the station." Arthur says, "Hey, go on the air. Let's see what you sound like." So I open up the mic, and
I said, "First time you're on Riff,
first time ever." And right. I said, "Hey guys, how's it going?" And the first thing ever, Arthur says, "Oh my God, he sounds like Costan." and it didn't take me long to figure out that there was only one Steve Costan, and there wasn't room for two of us. So I kind of had to figure out my own style at that point, you know.
So we're talking here with Mike Staff on the history of WRIF. So we've gotten through his young radio career, and now he just landed at Riff. And so now you're at Riff, you know, and you know Ann's there and Costan and Art and like all these legends and stuff. And so where did you think you fit in?
Well, you know, that's an interesting question because I felt like I was ready to be there. Like I felt like I had paid my dues,
right.
and I was ready to be at the Riff. And at the same time, I really respected and revered the people that I was working with because
right.
Mark Daddy Addy was at the station, Peter Werby, these guys that I was listening to early on, of course, Arthur listening to as well. So I knew my role. I knew I wasn't them, and I knew I just wanted to be a part of the team, you know, so I just kind of took that position like, hey, I'm just happy to be here working with you guys, and I want to learn as much as I can from you, and I'm happy to be on the air with you.
Now, I think I told you last time in our conversation that one of the guys I learned the most from in radio, just by watching and talking to, and obviously listening to, was Drew. So who do you think is one of the guys you learned the most from?
Oh, yeah, Drew, definitely. Drew and Zip got there about 6 months before I got to Riff. The way that Drew prepared for his shows, the way that he approached it was definitely inspiring. I still think it was probably Steve Costan, though, that really, because Steve was the music guy.
Right.
He was the local music guy. He knew what was going on. He knew everything about every album, every song, and that was kind of my lane because I loved the music so much. And, like, I can't tell you trivia about anything. There's some sports guys that can tell you who coached this team and that team and who scored this touchdown. I can do that for every rock album in the world, and that's the only thing that I had that kind of useless type of knowledge on. So that was my lane. Like, I know the music, I love the music, and let's talk about the music.
So I started on November 1st, 1995, and the first song I ever talked out of, if I'm not mistaken, was Alice Cooper's Elected, because it was right around election season, right? And so, and that was at 2 o'clock in the morning. Do you remember your first shift?
I do. My first shift at Riff, I'm going in at 2 o'clock in the morning. This is so funny because it was such a different era. And I walk into the studio. It's 1:30 in the morning, 1:15, and Mark Addy is in there with his wife, and they have candles everywhere. They have a bottle of wine. Just kind of like sitting there having this date while he's talking on the radio. And I was just like, wow, this is.
And then, of course, you get there, the lights go on, candles, right. candles are off.
This is totally interesting.
Yeah.
So he's leaving, and I'm like, hey, where's the music log? Because there is a music log, and you kind of follow along on the log. And Mark was like, there's no music log. You play whatever you want. It's called the Riff Rock Cafe. go nuts. And I'm like, wait a second, let me just get this straight so I can play anything I want. He says, anything.
Yeah, because overnights are not really rated and stuff.
Right,
and
no, like, not at all.
Yeah.
And I said, so I could play like the whole Pink Floyd The Wall if I want to. He's like, sure. I said, I could play Deep Triumph if I feel like it. Absolutely. I could play Metallica, no problem. Play whatever you want. And I was like, oh my gosh, this is the best gig in the world, you know. So I went nuts, and it was so much fun. And it was a lot more work when you have to actually pick all your own music. You know?
Right, because every DJ or any person that's ever been on the radio has that dream where they've got dead air, and they can't find a song, or they can't find a commercial or whatever. And so now all of a sudden it's like you're playing whatever you want, and you may have 30 seconds left. You're like, what do I play next? You know, and it's like you got to find something to play.
Right, and at this point there were still albums. There were some CDs, but most of the catalog were on albums.
Okay.
So you had to get the album out. You had to, like, clean off the album, put the needle on it, and all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, cue it up.
Yeah, so it took a lot longer than it does with the CD, right, or even now with MP3s, you know.
Yeah. Yes, okay, so you're on the air doing weekend stuff. So were you primarily, because the whole time that I was really there, you were like the main fill-in guy. You were the guy that they called if Art was sick or, you know, whatever the case was. So so how did you grow into that role?
Yeah, so I was there for about a year and a half, maybe 2 years, and Doug Podell was still in Cleveland. And then,
this is 93, 90?
This was 91 and 92. 92, 93, and about like, I think it's probably early 94.
Okay.
Doug becomes the program director of Wheel or of Riff. And that's what changed everything, because for those 2 years, I was pretty much buried in the middle of the night.
Right.
And then Doug came, and 3 days later, I was backstage at Pine Knob interviewing Alex Van Halen. Like, Doug just had confidence in me, and he trusted me, and I trusted him, and he started giving me massive opportunities, and it was never the same from that point
on. And was that your first rock star interview?
No, my first rock star interview was a band called Armored Saint.
Love those guys. I just interviewed John Bush like a month ago.
Really?
Loved, yeah. John
I
Bush,
like
great
those
guy.
Guys. They're really cool.
Great guy. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, good band. Really
great
good band.
John Bush is one of the most underrated hard rock singers in history, as far as I'm concerned.
Yeah, but my first major interview would have been, like, at Riff in the rock world would have been Alex Van Halen. Yep. But I was ready. Like, I was a little nervous, of course, but I was ready because I knew Van Halen. I grew up on Van Halen, and it was a very natural interview for me to have.
Now, as we record this, Eddie Van Halen just passed away 4 days ago.
Yeah.
We're just actually listening to some Van Halen in the house here. But so Alex, I'm sure, was great. Now, was this nowadays we do interviews and we record them, and we'll play clips on the air, but they mostly go on our podcast or on the internet or whatever. So was this live on the air?
It was live. Back then, all of our interviews were live. It wasn't even a possibility, really, to be, you know, doing them on tape and then playing them later.
I can remember interviewing Lars one time backstage at a concert, and I walked out of the backstage area. It's like 4:30 in the afternoon. Lars from Metallica. And I walk out, and every car in that parking lot had our station.
Yeah.
Like, it was so crazy.
Yeah, it's a trip. It's a total trip.
So what time was this when you were interviewing Alex?
Well, it would have been an afternoon drive with Art. Yeah, it became pretty quick that I was the guy that would go to the venues and I would do the interviews, because I knew the music, I knew these guys, and I was able to do pretty good interviews because I was a fan, you know.
So how'd that one go?
Well, that one went really, really good. I remember that we laughed a lot through the interview. Like, Alex was a really easy interview.
Yeah, he's a nice guy, yeah.
And he actually, like, listened, and he was really cool. Not all rockers are like that when you're interviewing them. Sometimes they're kind of in their own heads. But at that time, he was really into it. One of the best was I was interviewing Sammy Hagar at the I think it was the Fox. It might have been the State. Actually, it was the State Theater, which is now
The Fillmore.
And it was right after he left Van Halen. And so he's coming back to Detroit for his first time as a solo artist after Van Halen. And Art and I are on the air, and we're doing our little back and forth. And I said, yeah, you know, the last time Sammy Hagar was in Detroit as a solo artist was in 1984. He played Kobo. The Tigers were in the World Series. And he kept coming out between songs giving us the score of the game. And it was so badass. And we kind of, like, had this memory. So, I don't know, half hour, 45 minutes later, the record rep comes up and says, hey, Sammy's here. You want to go meet him? I'm like, yeah, sure. So I go backstage, and I meet Sammy, and he's totally cool. And we kind of talked about that you know, last time he was here, in the middle of the concert, he stops a concert and he's like, you know, Detroit, the last time I was here in 1984, I landed at Metro Airport and I turned on the Riff and I was listening to Arthur and Mike talk about the last time I was here. It was like, no way. You know,
that
it's
is
that
really
type
cool.
of stuff, which is just blows your mind.
Yeah,
you
I've know? Had I've had some artists do shout outs. I was remember one time in Three Doors Down, and Brad's like, hey, we were talking to Meltdown before the show, and my buddy's like elbowing me, you know, it's so fun.
It is so fun.
You know, and Sammy Hagar is one of the nicest guys in this business.
No question about it. He is.
You know, he told me one time, he said, dude, man, I can't remember if it was on the air or not, but he's just so easy to talk to and such a nice guy. But he goes, listen, man, I don't have to work again the rest of my life. I could just live off Van Halen money and I'm good.
Oh, yeah.
You know, but he continues to play and do right. all this stuff because he loves it, you know?
Yeah, he loves it. And he's a talker and
yeah.
and he's the real deal. He genuinely cares about people.
He does.
You know?
He's a really nice guy.
Yeah, he is.
So, what people may or may not know is that I got here in 1995, so I lost my job in Western New York in Buffalo in June of 1995. I met with Fred Jacobs, who you had on the podcast earlier this year, and he told me, he said, listen, something's going to break, but we can't tell you what it is or where it is, but just, you know, have patience. Well, I want to work. I want to continue my career. I can't be unemployed for that long. I was unemployed mm-hmm. for, I don't know, 5 months or whatever. And this job breaks here in Detroit. And they say, how would you like to come and work in Detroit? And my comment was, well, I'm not doing anything now. So, but what people may or may not know is that you were actually offered that job.
I was.
You were offered my gig, and you turned it down.
I did.
Yeah.
And it surprised me as much as I think it did Doug and Fred and everyone else. But
when do you remember when, what month or when about did they offer you that job?
Oh, I couldn't tell you. Yeah. I couldn't tell you. I just remember that, you know, Doug was a mentor as much as he was a boss. And he took me in his office. He's like, are you serious? Like, this is the gig you've been waiting for, full time on Riff. You've been working here for years, part time. This is your opportunity. The problem was I was making too much money on my side business. As a wedding DJ.
And what else?
And it just, that's basically it. And just wouldn't allow me the opportunity to do everything that I wanted to do. So I had a couple of things. I'm like, I can take it, but I still want to do interviews. And I still want to go out to Pine Knob. I still want to do all these interviews. He's like, no, if you get this job, you're going to have to come in and do overnights. And I'm like, well, that sucks. And then the other one was bar nights. Like, we made a fair amount of money from, you know, personal events at bar nights.
Right.
And they're a lot of fun, and I had these bars that I was at all the time. I just didn't want to give all that up to make about the same amount of money and get stuck in the middle of the night. For me, at that point, I felt like, man, this was really tough. So it was the hardest decision I ever made. I'm glad I did make it that way, because when you came, we were fast friends.
Yeah.
You were a great addition to the staff.
Well, thanks.
And I kind of got what I wanted, you got what you wanted, and here we are, you know.
Coming up.
The other time that I was on the air was during the O.J. chase.
Ah.
Down
so
the
was
road.
I, actually, in Buffalo.
Yep, I was on the air in
let's
Detroit.
Let's see if we said the same thing, so go ahead.
Well, it was just mind-blowing because we're watching it, just blowing our mind. And then I was on the air when they gave the verdict.
So I was going to say, did you guys cut from the to do it live?
For the verdict?
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Trudy came in into the studio with me. And
was Arthur on vacation a lot? Is that the problem?
Arthur was, but I think
I don't ever remember Arthur taking vacation time, but go ahead.
Yeah. Of course he did.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. Like most of us, Keith Urban also has a bucket list. You may be surprised to learn what is and is not on his. Text Keith to 45911 to read and learn more about the central theme of Keith's bucket list. Get a link to the story sent right to your phone when you text Keith to 45911. Go inside country music at BackstageCountry.com.
For nearly 50 years, we are, have been, and continue to be 101 WRIF.
What are you, crazy?
How do you remember? It was about 3 years ago.
How do I remember when I was there, as a matter of fact?
Yeah, I think that trip
Four
was a blur.
Ago.
Four. Mm-hmm. That long ago?
Mm-hmm.
I haven't been here that long. Do you?
I was sitting on the beach. A lot of people sitting around me. And
And I was screwing up.
And you were screwing up royally back here, and I was just trying to get it together. That's all.
I was not. I made one little mistake, and you blew your top at me.
No, I said, cool it. Get it together.
Something like that.
You're making us look silly back here in Hawaii.
Well, you already look silly sitting out there on the beach yard, so.
No, I do look pretty cool.
This is the History of WRIF, the podcast.
All right, sitting here in Traverse City with Mike Stamp. We got the fire cooking out in his backyard right here. I'll tell you what, riding my motorcycle up here this afternoon was really cool with all the leaves changing. Yeah, I wanted to ride my motorcycle up here last time.
Well,
so. You
didn't, though.
I didn't. No, it was supposed to rain.
Right, right. But you brought some good whiskey.
That's right. We got some whiskey out here.
Yeah.
And we're doing that whole thing, reliving Mike Staff's career. Normally, Mike is the one who hosts these podcasts. But I thought, you know what? Somebody needs to interview him.
Oh, I appreciate that, too, Meltdown.
Yeah, so I decided to come up here and hang out with Mike and talk about that. So throughout your career, we were just talking about this at lunch, that, you know, I just announced, you know, the death of Eddie Van Halen on the radio. You said that you heard me announce the death of Michael Jackson on the radio. And I remember saying it and kind of chuckling and giggling a little bit because I'm like, this can't possibly be true. So what milestone, like... you know, breaks, moments did you have in your career working at Riff?
Well, there's two big ones, but the thing is, like, when you make announcements like this, you know that people are going to remember it forever, because you don't hear about Eddie Van Halen's death and not remember where you were
right
when you heard it and how you heard about it. So it's a really profound, and it's kind of a personal thing to be able to deliver that kind of news to an audience, you know. The first time I did it was back in 1992, when back in the day before the internet, if you can even imagine the
internet. I don't remember that day, but
internet, we had AP services, which was like this...
it was a fax machine.
Yeah, it was basically a fax machine that news would constantly spit out.
Right.
And if anything really important happened, there was like a bell inside of it, and it would start ringing really loud. And the thing is, you almost never heard that bell, because very rarely would big news like that happen. So I'm in the middle of the night, it's probably 3 o'clock in the morning, and that bell starts going off, and I look at it, and it was Sam Kinison who had died.
Mm.
And I had to go on the air and deliver the news of Sam Kinison. And even then, I was cognizant of the fact, like, wow, this is a moment where people are going to remember this forever. They're going to remember how they heard that Sam Kinison died. The other time that I was on the air was during the O.J. chase.
I, actually, in Buffalo.
Yep, I was on the air
in
Detroit.
Let's see if we said the same thing, so go ahead.
Well, it was just mind-blowing, because we're watching it, and it's just blowing our mind. And then I was on the air when they gave the verdict.
So I was going to say, did you guys cut from to do it live?
For the verdict?
Yeah.
Trudy came into the studio with me. And
was Arthur on vacation a lot? Is that the problem?
Arthur was, but I think
I don't ever remember Arthur taking vacation time, but go ahead.
yeah, of course he did. I think it was about 1:30 in the afternoon that verdict came down.
Okay.
And I know Trudy came in, and we were like, okay, it's coming. We're just trying to kill time, because we weren't exactly sure when it was going to come out.
Yeah.
We didn't want to be in a commercial. We didn't want to be in a song. So we were just kind of bullshitting back and forth, and then it came out, and I just remember we both kind of looked at each other like, wow,
yeah,
is that really
right? Right.
You know, and then we kind of talked it through, and then we went into something, I don't know, but it was a really surreal moment to be on the air. And then, you know who else was on the air with us, now that I think about it, was Doug Llewellyn. He used to be like the host of the People's Court.
For sure. He was on the air with you guys?
Yeah, he was on
in
the
Detroit.
Air. Yeah, when the verdict was read with Trudy and I.
How did that happen?
I don't know. I can't remember any of it. I'm sure Drew and Mike had a line to him or something, and
wow,
we got him on the air. But it was the three of us on the air at the same time when the verdict came out.
Yeah, that was...
Doug Llewellyn is, like, you know, the expert commentator.
Right, right, right. That was right before I got to Detroit, because I remember I was watching the O.J. Simpson stuff when they called me. And I was getting ready to leave, going for a ride on my motorcycle.
Crazy.
Yeah. So anyway, so you're kind of doing, like, this fill-in, you know, pretty much for your whole time you were there.
Mm-hmm.
A guy would go on vacation, you'd take over for him, whether it was Art or Doug or whatever the case is. And then that was pretty much your entire career at Riff.
Well, it was. And what was really cool about it was that there was a lot of weeks that I had as much airtime as anyone else full time.
Right.
Because I was really Doug's primary fill-in guy, and Doug Podell is our program director. He was off a lot because he had programming things to do.
Right.
And then if Art took time off, and Lord knows Art took some time off.
I don't remember any of those times, but go ahead.
I would fill in for Art when you were doing nights, if you had time off, whenever anything was off. And then I was doing so much stuff on the streets, like every concert, every sporting event, everything that was going on. So I was busy, and I was making enough money because Riff had to pay me enough to be on call because I was always on call. Mm. So it was either like, hey, Mike needs to get another job and not be available, or you got to pay him to be available. Mm. And thankfully, they did. So it was a pretty cool gig because some weeks I wouldn't work very much, and those weeks would bum me out because I wanted to work. Yeah. I wanted to be doing what I was doing, you know.
How many interviews do you think you did at Riff?
Oh, gosh. Rockstars. That's a great question. I would say, I don't know. I'm just making something up. Oh, a couple hundred, probably.
Yeah. So who are some of your most memorable ones?
Boy, there are a lot of really good ones. You know, I loved the numerous Kiss interviews I did, and I'll tell you why, because every time I interviewed Gene Simmons or Paul Stanley, I wasn't expecting it. The hotline would ring, and I'd be on the air, and it would be one of those guys calling in, and for whatever reason, it was only those guys that nobody told me that they were going to be calling. You know? And if Paul Stanley calls the hotline and says, hey, I was told I can call in and do an interview,
you're going to interview him,
you know?
Right.
So those were really cool because I didn't have any time to think about them. Thank God I was a total fan.
Yeah.
And I was able to, you know, to just have a conversation with him. I interviewed Ted Nugent once on New Year's Eve. And Laura knows Ted can talk.
Yeah, he's a really tough interview.
Yeah, right. All you have to do is say hi, Ted.
Yeah.
And it was interesting because during the holidays, we're not being rated. At that point, at least, we weren't. So
there was a two-week window there.
Yeah, there was no, like, there's no pressure of a ratings period or anything. So you can get a lot looser on the air. Ted called, and he's talking about hunting or politics or something. And I had to cough, so I turned off my mic. And I just didn't turn it back on. And I realized that I didn't turn on my mic for almost 15 minutes. And Ted is just talking, you know. And he was really going off on politics at that point. And we ended up getting off the air. It was about a 35-minute interview. And we get off, and I pick up the phone, and we're in commercials. And off the air, Ted's like, holy shit, Staff, you're a maniac. I can't believe you just let me get away with that. I was like, yeah, Ted, be Ted. You know?
Yeah, Ted's a great interview. I remember one time, I think it was 2009, when Kiss was coming to play those final shows at Cobo. And the tickets went on sale for the first show. And I had Paul on like at 4 o'clock or something. And they sold out or whatever it was. They called me back, and I put him back on again for the second show.
Isn't that awesome?
Yeah, it was really cool.
Yeah, that's really, really cool. But see, back in those days, like, I remember talking to Kid Rock at 9:30 in the morning on a Saturday when tickets for his concert went on sale at 10.
Yeah.
Just to kind of pump the show,
right,
and make it cool. And it was a lot different then.
Well, that plus people had to stand in line to get tickets.
Right. Yeah, yeah. Way.
Yeah, and you had to, like, get up and, you know, make some sort of commitment to go get your tickets.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, now you do it from your, you know, from your basement with your pajamas on.
Yeah, right. There were some interviews that I did live on stage that were really cool. There was ones where Motley Crue gets back together. Of course, Vince Neil left. John Corabi came in. He left, and Vince Neil comes back.
And that was at the Fillmore.
And that was at the Fillmore. It was a state theater at the time. And it was a big deal. I mean, media from all over the country were at the state theater that night. Rolling Stone was there. MTV was there. It was a big deal. And after the concert, there was a Q&A.
Right.
So I got to be on stage with the band in front of 2,000 or 3,000 people doing an interview with Motley Crue, just about Motley Crue. And that was a really badass experience, too, you know, to be able to be that kind of live. That was really cool. And that was interesting as well, because I just give so much love and credit to Doug Podell, because I don't know why. I have no idea, because Doug was a fan of Motley Crue. He loved Motley Crue. But it was like halfway through the show, he comes up to me and says, hey, man, I'm going to leave. You want to do this interview? And I was like, what are you talking about? He's like, you just got to go up on stage and interview
the
band.
Yeah, just go up on stage. Yeah, how hard could that be?
Yeah, I'm there. So I had no notes. I had no prep. But again, it just goes back to being a fan.
Right.
I love Motley Crue. I knew what I would have asked them as a fan. Hey, you're back. Tell me about what's going on, you know?
Well, you know, there's an art to an interview, right? And it's like... people think you could just go up there and talk to Tommy Lee or Vince Neil like you're their friend. But, you know, you don't want to ask them the same questions they get all the time. You know, maybe for something like that, it's a little bit different because they're talking to so many people, right?
Right.
But you want your interview to be somewhat memorable. You want your interview to be to kind of stand out a little bit. You know, so you got to kind of go at it different angles. Like I was talking about with you last time, it's like when I interviewed David Lee Roth, I didn't ask him, was Van Halen ever going to get that together? I said to him, hey, aren't you bummed out you couldn't tour with Van Halen this year? And that opened up a whole Pandora's box that made a lot of news. And that's kind of, you know, that's... So in other words, what I'm saying is sometimes you have to prepare a little bit for that stuff. And so putting you on the fly like that, that's in many ways harder.
It is harder. It's and at the same time, it just goes back to you can't fake what we do. You've got to either be a fan or you're not a fan.
But sometimes, you know, in that thing, couldn't you have leaned on some of the fans for questions, right? Didn't they have a mic on
the
crowd
or
something?
Yeah, and that was really cool, too, because I probably asked maybe the first five or six questions.
Yeah, you like kind of prime the pump.
Yep.
And then if somebody wants to ask Nikki about snorting ants with Ozzy or whatever the case is,
right,
it's not on you.
It's not on me, and you can kind of reframe the question a little bit to make it a little bit more palatable for
me. Yeah, but everybody's there, so they heard it, you know, right, and, you know, exactly, whatever the case is.
There was a time when, of course, you know, Roger Waters left Pink Floyd, and he had a solo album, and there was like six radio stations around the country that had an opportunity to talk to Roger Waters. And it was all through, like, the satellite feed. So he was someplace, and everyone was in their own studios, and it was all recorded. And you got to ask, like, one or two questions. So it was K-Rock in New York that got to ask the first question. And then it was Riff that got to ask the second question. It was me. And I just went for it. I said, hey, Roger Waters, are you ever going to get back with Pink Floyd? And, of course, that is the soundbite that went live on MTV. It got quoted in Rolling Stone.
For sure, yeah.
It got quoted everywhere, you know, because that was the question, because Roger Waters was not an easy interview to get.
Yeah.
And you just didn't have an opportunity to ask a question like that. And that's the question that everyone wanted to know. So in that time, I think it was other DJs were like too cool to ask the obvious question.
Sometimes the obvious question is the one that people won't ask or for whatever reason don't ask.
Yeah. You know, I wasn't afraid to ask the obvious because that's all I really cared about.
Yeah, I talked to Nick Mason last year and I asked him kind of the similar question. He said it was pretty much between David and Roger. He said, those guys, you know, as long as they're doing their thing, it's not going to happen.
Yeah, right. So, what a shame.
So you just talked about Motley Crue. So I have to imagine that one of the highlights of your career at Riff was proposing on stage with Motley Crue. Take us to the beginning of how that ball started rolling, because in my 30 years in radio, I've never seen or heard something like that.
So the reason that happened, I was able to propose on stage, is because Tommy Lee and I were friends. And we became friends the very first time when John Corabi was actually singing for Vince Neil. And I was broadcasting from Pine Knob from the parking lot. And it's like 3:00 in the afternoon, so people aren't even really there yet.
Right.
And I'm doing my first break with Arthur, and we're just talking about Motley Crue at Pine Knob. And we see the tour buses come in. And there's nobody in the parking lot, so they just start plowing right at us, right at us, right at us. And I'm on the air, and I'm just saying, Art, I think the Motley Crue tour buses are pulling in, but they're coming right at us. And they stop right at us, and out jumps the band. And Tommy Lee, Mick Mars, Nikki Sixx, and John Corabi all come over.
Well, let me ask you this, because I saw that show in Buffalo before I got here. How many people were at that show? Because in Buffalo, there might have been 3,000.
Well, in Detroit,
in a 12, 15,000 seat venue.
Yeah, it wasn't sold out, but it was fairly full because Detroit loves a good rock show.
For sure,
know?
Yeah.
And so I was able to interview the band, and Tommy just happened to be standing closest to me, so I asked him most of the questions. It happened so spontaneously. We got off the air, and then I just started bullshitting with Tommy Lee, and I ended up getting on the tour bus with him. We go backstage, and we just kind of hung out for the night, and he was really cool, and we kind of connected. So every time he would come to town after that, he would look me up, or I would look him up, and we just saw each other a couple, maybe a dozen, 15 times in the next 4 or 5 years. So and, when it was time to propose to my girlfriend, you know, later my wife, I said, dude, I got this crazy idea. It's totally cool if you say no. I just want to bring it up. Can I propose on stage? And he said, yeah, man, no problem. So I thought maybe it would be like at the beginning of the concert,
right.
You know, and
right.
The lights are on. And he's like, no, dude, in the middle of the show. So he is married to Pam at the time, and they had some sappy little piano thing that Tommy was doing, and they were having pictures of Pamela and his son Brandon as a baby on the screen. And then after that, I was going to come up and propose. And that's what happened. So
wait a second. So hold on. So you're at the concert. This is at the Palace, right?
It's at the Palace, yeah.
Okay, so you're at the Palace, and your then-girlfriend is there.
Yep.
Okay. So you guys are watching the show?
Well, we're watching the show, and everyone was kind of in on it. So the people from the Palace were so cool, and they gave us a suite. So we had a suite, and I had all my, you know, a ton of friends in the suite, packed in the suite. And then
My invite must have got lost in the mail, but go ahead.
and then I introduced the band at the beginning of the concert. So then I go back to the suite, and we're watching the show, and then I knew it was coming up. I knew what song to wait for and everything. And then I said, hey, to my girlfriend, hey, Danny, you want to go down? And, like, I'm going to, like, bring on the band again for the encore. You want to come down? And she's like, no, I'm good with all of our friends.
Of course he did.
And, of course, all the friends are like, go, go, go. So she went down, and you know, we went down there. We got backstage, and she was not a public person. She didn't really like being in front of people. And so, you know, Tommy gets done with his little piano thing, and he goes up to the, you know, the front mic. And he's like, hey, Detroit, you know this crazy psycho, don't you? And I walked out and kind of, introduced myself again. And
okay,
then,
wait a second. Hold on. Danny's on the side of the stage.
Danny's
still.
On the side okay. of the stage. The whole band is on the stage.
Okay.
I'm in the center of the stage on the mic. And I'm like, hey, this is really awesome. I said, I want my girlfriend to come out and check this out.
Oh, boy.
And I look at her, and she's looking at me like,
no,
no, no, no, no. And Tommy grabs her and brings her out on stage. And she's in front of me, and I dropped to one knee. And,
of course,
she knew what was going on, you know. And we got the sweet picture of the whole band behind me on the risers, like with their arms in the air. And I'm on one knee, and Danny's got her hands over her face. And it was just, it was really cool. And then after, thank God she said yes.
Yeah,
and then,
no doubt.
You know, and then after it, they set us on the stage, and they played Home Sweet Home to us. And that was really just.
So you sat on the stage when they did that?
Yeah, I'm
thinking to myself as you're telling that story, I was probably on the air, so I might not have even been there. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'm sure I was not there for sure because I would have remembered that. But I knew, of course, I knew about it.
Yeah, and so that was in 1997. The bummer thing about it is that, like, there weren't the phones that were available today.
Right, cell phone, yeah.
Yeah, if I did that today, I would have video perspective from every seat in the house.
Oh, yeah, no doubt, yeah.
You know, but I did have a videographer in front in the pit, and then there's one guy that happened to be bootlegging the show that sent me some video of it from kind of back in there, and we kind of pieced it all together for a cool video for our kids and everything.
So, I mean, obviously, that's got to be your highlight at Riff.
That was a highlight of my life, probably. Yeah. You know, that was a really unbelievable moment.
Coming up.
When I retired from Riff, which is really what I did, I was young. I was 37 when I retired from radio. I was going towards a brand new dream, which is living in Traverse City and raising my family here. But I cried every day for 2 weeks after my last shift and Riff because I loved it so much. It was a dream come true.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music. It's going to be a busy year for country superstar Jason Aldean. He's extended his Highway Desperado tour and is teaming up with Kid Rock for Rock the Country tour dates. We've ranked our top five Jason Aldean music videos. Text Jason to 45911 to see if your favorite made the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Jason to 45911 and we'll send the link straight to your phone.
101 minutes of non-stop riff rock.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
Party with the Riff all weekend long because it's Big Daddy's Foreplay Weekend on 101 WRIF. Riff rocks, baby.
All right, so we've come to the part of the show where I'm just going to throw out some questions here, and we'll see what your answers are, okay?
Okay.
All right, so how many times have you knocked yourself out by a cart rack?
One time.
Okay, well, that's one more than I ever did.
Yeah, right.
So for people that don't know, they're listening right now, a cart rack, back in the day, we had these carts, and they were like 8-tracks, but they were called carts, and they would have commercials on them or songs or whatever. And so we had these racks. And they were, you know, maybe 6 foot high in the studio or whatever. So what happened?
Well, so I was in Youngstown working overnights and bringing on home from Led Zeppelin, I played. And I used to air jam a lot. I loved air jamming. And I was air jamming, bringing on home. And then it kicks in. And I just threw my head back in an air jam. And I hit myself in the head. And I literally knocked myself out. To the point where I woke up, I have no idea how long I was out, but there was dead air, and there's a little alarm on the board when there's no sound coming through going,
That alarm probably didn't go off for at least a few minutes.
I have no idea how long it was, but I actually went back on the air, and I instantly opened up the mic, and I told my listeners what happened. I said, you would not believe what happened.
All right, so.
It was really funny.
Mike Staff 0, cart rack 1. All right, there we go. All right, another question here for you. Have you ever had your car completely covered with promo pictures of you?
I did. You know, when I finally decided to move to Traverse City to raise my family, I quit Riff. I had to after 14 years, and I had Riff was so gracious and so cool. They threw this party for me. And I had all these old promo pictures, and they cut out my face, and they just put them everywhere, and it was really funny. But I got to tell you, Meltdown, when I retired from Riff, which is really what I did, I was young. I was 37 when I retired from radio. But I was going towards a brand new dream, which is living in Traverse City and raising my family here. But I cried every day for 2 weeks after my last shift and Riff because, A, I loved it so much. It was a dream come true. And I felt so much love from everyone at Riff. I have this picture of my last shift at Riff, which was at Harley Fest at Freedom Hill. And everyone was there. You were there. Ann was there. Doug was there. Drew was there. Arthur was there. Everyone was there for my very last break. And it meant the world to me. So I was just like going around in my head for weeks like, wow, that was like, what an awesome trip that happened so fast. That 14 years at Riff and 20 years in radio just flew by. And at the same time, like, I'm going towards a brand new dream.
Yeah.
You know, it was just a very bizarre time in my life.
How long did it take you to decide that you wanted to, as you say, retire from Riff and just kind of retire from the radio business?
Yeah, it took a little while. You know, when I first started my radio career and I was living in Traverse City, I fell in love with it. And the people that grew up in Traverse City loved being raised in Traverse City. So I really set myself a goal that I was going to raise my kids in Traverse City. So when my youngest was a year and a half, I knew it was time. And my oldest was almost ready to be in kindergarten. That was the goal, to be here before she was in kindergarten. Mm-hmm. And I just kind of felt like the pressure was on. And my business was really taking off, so I can afford to do it. And at that time, I felt like I had accomplished everything that I needed to accomplish in radio. I had interviewed all my heroes. I was a part of the team at Riff that I wanted to be a part of. I felt like I was valued on that team and that I contributed to that team. I just felt like it was a really good time to kind of like end it on top, you know?
Who were some of your heroes that you interviewed at Riff? You mentioned heroes. So, I mean, obviously you talked about, Tommy and Alex and stuff like that.
Yeah, I got to interview, interview just about every single one of my heroes. Like, I had a chance to meet Robert Plant of Led Zeppelin, who was like the ultimate to me.
Right.
Met the Rolling Stones. I got to interview Aerosmith. Interviewed Metallica a number of times. Interviewed Kid Rock a bunch of times. It was just absolutely amazing. You know, when I was a kid in high school, Triumph was one of my favorite bands. And Rick Emmett is a guitar player in Triumph.
And a singer, yeah.
Yeah. And you.
Well, I was going to ask you earlier if Danny would have said no, would you have proposed to Rick Emmett?
so let's tell her. so I was a huge, Rick Emmett is a guitar player and singer of the band Triumph. I know a lot of people listening right now probably don't even know who Triumph is.
Come on,
but
now.
They were a big band in the 80s, yeah. And they were my favorite band. They had a lot of really super positive lyrics. I identified with them.
Yeah, they were a three-piece band from Canada outside of Rush.
Yeah, they were great.
Yeah.
And so I had a chance to interview Rick Emmett in the studio. He brought his guitar, and I'm interviewing him, and like I think it's going great. I'm super excited, obviously, to be interviewing my hero. And the interview's over, and I walk out, and the guys from promotions were just like, wow, could you have blown him anymore? I was like, what do you mean? And they're like, damn, dude. And I was like,
well,
oh,
that's
my.
That's a good thing about radio guys. We're not very sarcastic.
Right?
Or ball busting.
Yeah, not at all. So like, I'm freaking out. I'm like, oh, my God. Did I come across a little bit too strong? So Rick Emmett was playing at the Seventh House in Pontiac that night, and he let me introduce him on stage, and I got the front row, and he asked me if there's any songs I wanted him to play.
Oh, for God's
like,
sake.
I'm the guest of the night, you know? So I introduce him, and then he's playing a show, and then he says, hey, this is for Mike Staff from Riff. I was on the show today. He says, Mike likes me. It was honestly the most embarrassing moment of my life. You know, and I'm just like, whoa, I hope Rick Emmett didn't take that wrong. You know, I'm a fan. That's about it.
You know? That is hysterical.
It is. But, you know, sometimes doing what we do, I just didn't really feel the need to pull back on my fandom because I love rock and I love the people that I had a chance to interact with. So to me, I'm just like all in or nothing at all.
Yeah, Rick's a really nice guy, and it's like, he's Canadian, so all Canadian guys are nice. I mean,
is that how it is?
Yeah, Canadians and the Southern bands.
Right, yeah, Southern bands are nice. Really cool.
You know? So you host the history of WRIF. So we're, I think, 11 episodes in. I don't know if I can say this or not, but you said that you talked to Drew, and Drew's going to try to make an appearance coming up.
Yep, Drew is coming up. Yeah. I'm very excited about that. I'm very hopeful Doug Podell is going to come up as well.
Yeah, there's some others that you're kind of chipping away and working at.
Yeah.
So give me some of the highlights of what you've done so far on the Riff podcast, and maybe some of the things that surprised you or that you learned.
I'm really glad you asked that, Meltdown, because the podcast has been such a, just kind of a, well, it is what it's called, the history of WRIF.
But it's kind of like a chance for you also to reconnect.
It's a chance to reconnect, and it's from the guy who's probably one of the biggest Riff fans ever.
Yeah.
Because, like I said, I was a fan from I'm 4 years old,
yeah.
You know? And here's the thread that is seamless throughout the whole story of Riff is that every DJ that has ever been on the station, whether it's JJ, Ken Calvert, Arthur P, any of them, Peter Werby, all of them will say that Riff is the best thing that ever happened to them. It was just such a camaraderie, and it was just such a kind of like an era in each of the eras that was so significant in the lifespan of not only Detroit, but of rock radio.
It's like, you know, it's like, I think that Detroit and how you say they, you know, Detroiters can sniff out, you know, a fraud.
Yep.
It kind of goes in the grain of the whole Midwestern thing. You know what I'm saying? These are real people.
Yeah, there's no doubt. Tom Wright, I had the opportunity to do the interviews for a documentary that won an Emmy called The Grandy Ballroom Story.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
And Tom Wright, who was the manager of The Who, who also managed the Grandy Ballroom, he said it best when he said, Detroit works on eight-hour shifts, and it plays and parties on eight-hour shifts.
Yeah.
That is so true. Like, that is the heartbeat of Detroit. And in Detroit, we don't have time for fake anything.
Right.
That if you want something real, you're going to come to Detroit. It starts with Motown, but you got the MC5, you got Ted Nugent, you got Bob Seger, you got Kid Rock, you got Eminem. Those guys are real. The thread that is consistent through all of their music, it's real.
Right.
Nobody's trying to bullshit anyone.
Right.
And Riff had to stand up to that, or it would have been sniffed out like every other radio station since.
Yeah, there was a quote from Ted Nugent that was on our former program director Mark Pennington's office that said, you know, nobody tells Riff what to play. It's
right.
like, and no one does.
Yeah, that was one of the cool things is that when Riff added a song, you would see like 50 other radio stations in the country add a song. I had the chance to broadcast from the MTV Video Music Awards in New York City twice and the MTV Movie Awards in L.A. once time from Riff. And what was so cool about it is that like the first time I go to New York City, and there's radio stations from all over the country there, and we're all set up underneath Radio City Music Hall in the basement the day before the award show. And they give you like a form that says like, who do you want to interview? You know, who do you want to talk to? And I was like, wow, you know, how many people can I check off? And they're like, as many as you want. So I just checked off everyone. The cool thing was, is that it was K-Rock was number one. MTV Radio Networks was number two.
And K-Rock, by the way, is in Los Angeles.
Well, it was, no, K-Rock in New York.
No, there was K-R-O-Q?
No, but there's a K-Rock in L.A., but there's also a K-Rock
okay, there
in,
was.
In
okay,
New
yeah,
York.
Okay, yeah, go ahead. K-Rock in Los Angeles is still there, but K-Rock, I think, is gone in New York City. But anyways, go ahead.
Right, yeah, this was 1996 or 7.
Okay, yeah.
And so, but anyway, there's like 20 or 30 radio stations, and Riff was number three.
Yeah.
And number two was MTV radio,
right. Yeah.
You know, and like the credibility that Riff has as a national scene is really pretty impressive.
Yeah, times are a lot different right now, obviously, than they were in 1996, right?
Right.
But I feel like with my podcast and stuff, that it carries some weight. And I'll tell the publicist, listen, I want to be last. If an artist is doing like a press junket, and they're doing 10-minute interviews with stations or podcasts or whatever, I say I want to be last. And you know what they do? They put me last. And it gives me a little bit more time, and I don't have to worry about, you know, bumping into somebody else or, you know,
well,
whatever the case is.
And he can ask different questions.
Well, it's kind of a double-edged sword, too, because sometimes when you're last, it's like, okay, has this guy answered this question 18 times already? You know,
right.
So you got to kind of do that whole thing, too.
Right.
So anyways, yeah, it's like, The podcast is really killer, man. Congratulations on doing that. I've really, to be honest, I've learned a lot about the station I work at.
Yeah, right.
And I have for half my life.
It's amazing.
Just by listening to the podcast.
Right. It's amazing. And we have some really good podcasts coming up. And I am beyond humbled and thrilled to have been asked to be the host of this podcast because, A, I'm a big fan of WRIF, and the people that I get to interview have become friends.
Yeah.
And I just think it's a really cool thing for Detroit radio listeners to know more about the radio station that they love the most.
This is the history of WRIF, the podcast.
BackstageCountry.com, your online home for all things country music.
Picking five of Carrie Underwood's best music videos was no easy task, but after some debate, we landed on five we believe rise to the top. Did Carrie's 2014 hit Something in the Water make our top five? Find out when you text Carrie to 45911 and scroll through the list on BackstageCountry.com. Text Carrie to 45911 to get your eyes on our favorite Carrie Underwood music videos.